have the real spiritual group here today for second service. Those that aren't concerned about getting to the restaurant first today. So our text is Hebrews 12. Going to be looking at verses 3 through 17. And as you are opening there, you might get the sense that this is a familiar passage, one that you've heard before. And that would be because we studied this passage last week. And we're looking at it again this week, all right? Reminded me of an encounter that a pastor had with some of the members of his congregation after he had preached from the same text, the same sermon for 6 weeks. And finally, someone worked up enough nerve to kind of come up alongside this pastor and say, hey, let's move on, you know, time to do some new prep. And the pastor replied, well, as soon as you get this passage, then we'll move on to the next one. So that was his retort. Well, I'm not trying to drive home an axe here, but it is just a loaded text. And I realized late in my preparation last week that we had too much to try to cover in one teaching time. So we're going to come back to this and give a bit of an overview, but then look specifically and focus in on verses 12 through 17, the part that we really didn't get to last week. So that'll be our tack. So I want to begin with the same question I asked last week, though, and that is, have you hit the wall? Have you experienced what that is? We talked in terms of running. We talked about Art Carey's the columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and that great piece that he wrote about his experience in the Boston Marathon. And we recounted that and I read you an excerpt of that, and you got to kind of get inside of his mind and all the mental gymnastics and the things that go on when you're pushing yourself to the limits, right? And hitting that proverbial wall that a runner hits. I know we have some riverbank runners that were here today. And they survived yesterday. They pushed themselves through. So we think about it in the context of running, but obviously my question is broader than that. Have you hit the wall? Have you come to a place where you don't feel like you can go any further in life? Maybe specifically as it relates to your faith. Tired, agonizing through difficult life circumstances, struggling to put one foot in front of the other one more day. Tired of swimming upstream. You're tired of swimming upstream in culture? I get tired of swimming upstream. Just feeling like I'm just kind of at odds with people around me. You know, that's hard. Tired of serving others. Can I say that as a pastor? Just tired sometimes when you don't see progress, you don't see receptivity, you sometimes don't feel like your efforts are meaningful or really producing what you would like to see them produce. Tired of unrelenting responsibilities. A to-do list that never ends. And of course, that part of that's just life and it's part of being human. But there are some responsibilities that we have because we're followers of Jesus, right? There's a whole additional set of responsibilities. And sometimes we get weary in doing good, right? In serving Christ and following Christ. So you could add your own life specifics. But have you hit the wall? You know what that is like. Perhaps you're even there now. The author is writing to weary, exhausted people. He even uses a term here that's the term for agony. The people that are agonizing. they're just struggling in life. And he is urging them to endure to the end, to continue in the race. We noted, even in reading Art Carey's account there of his Boston Marathon run, and just the short excerpt I read to you, how much there was in the mind, Right? We tend to think of something like that as being physically demanding, and that certainly is true. And yet there's all of these mental gymnastics that are going on where he's having to talk to himself in a certain way, processing, you know, keep going, don't go too fast, don't cramp up. You know, we got this distance, save some for that. You know, he's thinking about all of these things. This is all part of what's going on. And the author here seems to have something similar in mind. He's wanting to shape their thought processes. These people who are running the race of life, living out their faith, weary at the end of their rope, and they are needing to be renewed in their perspective. So that's largely where we spent our time last week. First of all, looking at the analogy of Jesus. That's the first thing he says to them, verses 3 and 4, consider Jesus. We might even say, compare yourself to Jesus. Jesus endured such hostility at the hands of sinful men. Such hostility, right? Even to the point of death on a cross. And then the author says, you and your struggle against sin have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. You've suffered, but nothing like what Jesus suffered. And he wants them to think about that, that contrast, in the midst of their own very real struggles. So that's one perspective. Consider Jesus. He wants them to bring their own suffering into perspective alongside the sufferings of Christ, right? But then there's a second perspective, verses 5 through 11, and that is that he wants them to remember or consider the nature of God's discipline. That God is at work in shaping our lives and our character. That while there is the activity of sinful people, right, with Jesus and these people, they were encountering sin and sinful people, malicious people who were out to get them. But at the same time, in the same circumstances, God was working. And God was carrying out his discipline. And God was growing them up and helping them to be mature. God was being a father to them. And he was not shielding them from hard things, right? God is not a permissive parent. He's not a coddling father. He is willing to allow his children to endure hard things for their own good and for their maturity, okay? So this is the other category and framework that we ought to think in is the discipline of the Lord. James McDonald gives this definition. It's a good one. Discipline is a painful circumstance allowed by God to transform my character and my conduct. So we have to have that type of perspective as we walk through these aspects of difficulty and suffering. By the way, on this Mother's Day, let me extend an exhortation to dads. I'll talk to myself and to other dads in the room that this whole arena of discipline is the task primarily of fathers. That's not to say that a mom doesn't discipline the kids or train them, either by means of punishing disobedience or just shaping their character. It's all part of what discipline is. But that dads have the primary role and responsibility. So in an Ephesians passage, right, fathers, do not exasperate your children, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, the instruction and discipline of the Lord. That is a task primarily directed to dads. And I would suggest to you one of the greatest gifts you could give your wife would be to engage with your kids and to be active in their teaching, in their instruction, in their discipline. Don't abdicate that to mom, all right? So certainly we see that. Here's God, the preeminent example of a father who is undertaking this task of disciplining his children. Now, we obviously have a bit of an aversion to discipline in our culture. This is not a popular notion. The idea of having some painful intervention in the life of our child, of letting them suffer, or worse yet, actually implementing some painful circumstance into their life, is thought to be harsh and is thought to be unloving. And so we need to get that idea out of our minds, right? That love is not a pampering notion. Love is not sort of acting in a way that is pleasurable. Love often involves something that is hard and painful. So we have to kind of grapple with that and understand that discipline is good. So I think sometimes we reject God's discipline, or we struggle with God's discipline, because the idea of discipline really isn't part of our lives. As parents, or as children, or as church members, we don't see that as like an important thing. And so we got to realize in this passage how important discipline is, how fundamental it is to a parent-child relationship. It's critical. So he deals with that and expands on that in verses 5 through 11. If you have a problem with discipline, painful physical discipline, then you're going to have a problem with God and understanding your relationship with God. All right? So we need to get a handle on that. There's a song out recently by Hawk Nelson, Diamonds Out of Dust. Catchy little tune. Have you heard this on the radio? God's making diamonds out of dust. He's making diamonds out of us. Parker's down here nodding. She's heard that song, I think. Yeah, it's a great little tune. And there's a couple lyrics that just stood out to me as I was hearing it this week. When the pressure is on, he's making diamonds. You know, so in other words, when there's difficulty, when there's struggle, what's happening there? Well, God is doing something, right? God's making diamonds. Another metaphor to think about this. Another line there in that song, oh, it's not what I hoped for, it's something much better. So I never would have pursued this difficult circumstance. It's not what I would like, but I can see that actually God's doing something better that I couldn't really conceive of. He's accomplishing things in my life that are hard, but that are really good. So a lot of ways of thinking about this. Parenting and that relationship, when we understand discipline works there, and we think about something like a diamond, and we understand how it is produced under pressure over time, and those kinds of notions can help us think about suffering. So two questions that are going to lead us on for the remainder of our time here. One, quickly, are you a child of God? This is the text there in verses 5 to 11 talks a lot about how every child is disciplined by their father. And every one of God's children is going to experience discipline. It is unavoidable and inescapable. And God doesn't discipline those that aren't his children. So there's sort of this fundamental question that I think needs to be asked. Am I one of God's children? We shouldn't assume it. Not everyone is God's child. But I think this text causes us to think about that. Now, you might say, if I'm not God's child, that means I'm not going to be disciplined. And that sounds pretty good to me. But I'm not sure we would really mean it. Remember that story from last week? I talked to you about John Perkins, young African-American boy who recounted the day as a young child that his father left him, never to return. And he thought about some of those instances when his father disciplined him, and he longed for his father. Yeah, I think somewhere deep down, whether we would acknowledge it or not, we long for a loving father who cares enough to discipline us, to invest in our lives. John Perkins grieved for the rest of his life because he didn't have that father. And God is in the business of adopting homeless children. This is what God does. And that opportunity is there through faith in Jesus Christ to have your sins forgiven, to go from being an enemy of God to being God's son or daughter. And so sort of this fundamental question that lies behind this text, are you a child of God? And we'd love to talk with you more. If God's working in your heart in that domain, to think about how you would answer that question, or you're not sure how to answer it, we would love to talk with you more about that. The second question is one that we'll dwell on a little bit longer here in our remaining time. How should you respond to God's discipline? If you are one of God's children, then how do you respond to God's discipline? Chapter 12, verses 3 to 11, describe God's discipline of his children. And then verse 12, therefore. So God disciplines his children. You're God's children. Therefore, in light of that, this is what you should do. And we receive several practical exhortations of how to respond to the discipline of the Lord. And that's what I wanted to just make sure we gave enough time to, all right, why we're lingering on this passage again this week. So let me recount those exhortations of how we are to respond to God's discipline. A little bit of review. We touched on the first couple last week. But number one, stay in the race. Stay in the race. So verse 12, therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint but rather be healed. So it's back to the running terminology, right? He's calling them to endure, to finish the race. And here he's picking up some of that terminology again. He's talking to people who have drooping arms, right? And weak knees. Their knees are kind of like jello. Feel like they're going to buckle under them. Maybe they feel a little bit faint at this stage in the race, 20 miles into the marathon. And he is urging them to strengthen those, to continue on, to keep pushing, to keep striding. This terminology is also used in a passage in Isaiah. And the context of that passage might lead us to think that there's also a group idea here. It's not just that the author's pointing to individuals here and saying, hey, keep going. But he's saying to them collectively, keep going. And so some of the scenes that Art Carey described there, coming to mile 20 and going up Heartbreak Hill and seeing some people walking arm in arm, you know, helping one another get up that hill and make a final push. You know, there might be a group aspect to this exhortation to keep going. And then this interesting command to make straight paths for your feet, or literally pursue the level paths. I take this to mean in the context here of the race and the course that's been marked out for you, that this is a charge to pursue and stay on the course. Don't deviate from the course. Continue in the race. Stay on the course. With the warning that if you don't, if you get off the marked out course, the level path, the groomed trail, and you get into the tall grass and the uneven rocks, that you're going to find yourself in trouble. You're going to end up putting something out of joint. You're going to have a painful dislocation. So running and continuing on is going to be difficult. The author acknowledges that, but urges them to stay on the course, to don't get off track, to don't leave the course that God has marked out for you, right? I was in a store this weekend and talked to a lady behind the counter who was just very cautious in her movements. I mean, she's just operating the cash register, but it was taking a while for every different motion. And I said to her, I said, "You look like you're in pain." And she said, "Funny you should say that." And she said, "I just got back from Florida. It was supposed to be a one-week trip, and it was a seven-week trip because I fell and broke both arms." And so she's been in this, and she's notably being very careful about her movements, right? So as not to aggravate, to not cause further damage. I was talking to Marilyn Veltman, our own Marilyn Veltman, who's had knee surgery, and she's a knee replacement, and she's doing very well. But I was talking with her at the rehab place this week, and Jim Seitzman and I stopped by to see her, and she says, "Man, they're really on me about this walker business, you know, and I'm only 80, you know, I'm fine. I don't need that walker." I'm Marilyn. Use the stinking walker, right? I mean, use the walker. You know, when you're in a diminished condition, you're weakened. The text actually says lame. To talk about these drooping arms and weak knees, it's a word that's used to describe people who are paralyzed. They're unable to move. I mean, when you're in a weakened state, when you're discouraged, depressed, demoralized, fatigued, tired, do not deviate from the course. Stay on track, all right? Stay in the race. Some of you are inclined or tempted to leave the course in the midst of your discouragement. Some of you have left the course. Some of you have stepped outside God's moral boundaries, whether that's in the realm of sexual purity or ethics of other kinds or something, but you've deviated from God's course. Hear the exhortation here. In the midst of the difficulty that you're facing, continue to stay in the race. Number two, actively pursue the goal. Actively pursue the goal. Look at verse 14. "Strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord." So he's asking them to go after two things: peace with everyone and holiness. I want you to pursue these things. Go after these things in your life. It's like the things that are out in front of you, or should be out in front of you. Go after them. I believe what's happening here is that these are God's goals for us. And he is saying, get on board with what God is doing. See, in discipline, God is trying to grow us up. He's trying to make us mature, particularly in our relationships with each other, right? That we live at peace with one another. That's what Christian maturity looks like. It means I'm patient with people. It means I'm moving towards people. It means I'm committed to people. I'm serving people. This is Christian maturity. Not knowing the books of the Bible frontwards and backwards and being able to recite memory verses. Christian maturity is living at peace with one another. I can speak graciously even when we disagree, right? And Christian maturity is holiness. It's obeying God's commandments. So this is what God is doing in our lives when he's disciplining us. And I think the author here is saying, get on board. Get lined up with what God is trying to do in your life. There's a reason why I'm suggesting this, okay? So let's go back to verse 10. Consider what's been said earlier here. "For they," that is our earthly fathers, "for they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he," that's God, "disciplines us for our good that we may share his holiness." What is God doing in discipline? Why is he allowing hard things into your life? To shape your character and your conduct. He's moving you towards holiness. He's helping you realize how selfish you are, right? He's helping you to realize in the midst of turmoil that you have an anger problem, right? And he's wanting to shape that aspect of your character. Get on board with what God is wanting to do. Align yourselves with his goals. If God's trying to take you here and you're trying to go there, we've got a problem. And let me just say, you're going to come out on the losing end of that problem, right? So he's wanting them to pursue and give their effort towards the things that God is trying to accomplish in their lives. Pursue the goal. I love how verse 10, did you catch that? God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. I think sometimes we think, this is what I want to do, and this is what I think would really make me happy. But God says this, okay, and I'm going to put those things aside and do what God says, because I know that's what I should do. That's not what's going on here. When we pursue God's holiness, when we walk in obedience to his commands, that is for our good. That is best. That is what's going to bring you the most joy and the most fulfillment. It's going to bring you the most sense of purpose in your life. It is good. So God, in disciplining us, God is not only causing us to share in his holiness, but he's contributing to our good. Love how that comes together. You might think you know what would really make you happy. You don't. Let me just tell you. Whatever it is you got out there, if I just had that, I'd be happy. God knows what will make you happy. God made you. He knows how your body works. He knows how your mind works. He knows how your soul works. He knows what will bring you satisfaction. If you pursue God's ways, that will be not only for his glory, it will be for your good. Actively pursue the goal. Notice verse 11, it goes on. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. So what is discipline producing? Righteousness. There's that theme of holiness or righteousness or purity again, but it's the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Now we have the element of peace again here. So the author's bringing us back to these things. This is what God's doing. Pursue these things. Put your mind to these things. It will require a very intentional, ongoing effort. The word here for strive is a very strong word. It's used mostly of persecution. When the Apostle Paul, before he came to Christ, he was persecuting Christians. It says that he was pursuing them or persecuting them even into foreign lands. I mean, he was hell-bent on punishing and making life miserable for Christians. And we are to pursue in that same way peace and holiness. What are you pursuing? What is your life about? And is it possible that you need a course correction? Because if you're pursuing something other than what God's pursuing, you're going to be miserable. Right? So how do you respond to God's discipline? You get on board with it. You fall in line with it. And by the way, God isn't messing around when it comes to this topic of holiness and peace. He expects us to pursue these things. And I think Kevin DeYoung's statement is right on board. No matter what you profess, no matter what you say, if you show disregard for Christ by giving yourself over to sin impenitently and habitually, then heaven is not your home. That's what the text says here, right? Pursue these things without which no one will see the Lord. If you want to call God your father, then you better start living like his son or his daughter. God expects that in no uncertain terms. Get on board with what God is trying to accomplish in your life. Number three, make sure you don't miss the grace of God. Verse 15, see to it. This is a word that has to do with vigilance and guarding. See to it. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God. I think what the author is saying here is that God's discipline is a gift. It's a demonstration of his grace. He loves us enough to discipline us, to shape our character, to grow us up. If you reject or spurn God's discipline, you have spurned and rejected God's grace. He's extended a gift to us, and you have pushed it back across the table. And I think the author is saying, be careful that you don't fail to obtain God's grace. I talked about my experiences in physical therapy with some of my back issues and people putting elbows into certain, this little square inch portion of my back and sending me through the roof and bending me in ways that my body has never been bent. Painful, but really good, right? Look at this out of Hosea. The people of Israel had been in exile. They had experienced tremendous hardship. The prophet says, come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us that he may heal us. He has struck us down and he will bind us up. I mean, this is like words of a surgeon who cuts you so that he can heal you, right? Who causes you pain so that you can be well. And sometimes we don't realize what's happening when the scalpel's coming at us, right? Or we're fighting that elbow as we're laying on the table. We don't realize that it's for our good. Now, my mom, I was thinking about my mom, being Mother's Day and all. And my mom is, if you've met my mom, you will remember my mom. She's a great lady, godly lady. She is a saver, saves everything. She's extremely generous. And she's kind of a garage sailor. She's always looking for a good deal. So Christmases are interesting. Mounds of gifts, very few of which are purchased gifts, or at least new gifts. They're trinkets and things that she's picked up along the way at sales. And they're packaged in boxes that she has saved. And a variety of boxes. And sometimes it's a diaper box. And sometimes it's a toolbox. And my kids have come to recognize that they look past the packaging because they know it probably has nothing to do with what's actually in the box, right? And I'm convinced that we have to think that way as it relates to God, that sometimes the packaging of discipline, I'm not interested in that. I push it back across the table. We don't realize the gift that is inside that package. And if we're not careful, we will fail to receive the grace of God. We will fail to receive his gifts because we will reject them out of hand. And the author is cautioning them, please do not reject the gift of God's grace. Number four, guard against bitterness. We can be inclined to grow bitter in the face of difficulty. Wonder, why is this happening to me? What have I done to deserve this? Imperceptible at first, right? The language here is that of a root. Do not allow a root of bitterness to take hold. It's under the surface. No one sees it. You might not even be cognizant of it. But it has latched on and become grounded there, and as all roots do, they will spring up. I have some vines I've been trying to eradicate, and I think I have them all because I have everything on the surface, and then sure enough, I didn't get all of the root, and something else will spring up. That's what roots do. They spring up, and that bitterness will spring up, and it will not only impact you, but it will defile many, the text says. All from this little root of bitterness. So as you encounter God's discipline and painful circumstances that you wish that God would remove, and you know that he could remove, and why doesn't he remove them? And this person has treated me so unfairly. And perhaps they have, right? That's what's in view here. Jesus endured such hostility, and these people had struggled against sin, verse 4. But at the same time, in the midst of that, God was doing his work. So don't get so upset at the sin that is perpetrated against you that you miss what God is trying to do in your life. Don't get so bitter at the sin that you are unable to benefit from the discipline. All right? Guard against bitterness. And finally, guard against desensitization. Vocab word of the day. Verse 16, see to it that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. For you know that afterward, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no chance to repent, though he sought it with tears. Guard against desensitization. Esau, you might remember the account of Esau and his twin brother Jacob. Esau was the oldest. He stood to inherit the blessing from God. But Esau was a man driven by his appetites. He was driven by sexual appetites. He married two unbelieving women that were a source of great grief and led his heart astray. And he was also just driven by his physical appetite, his stomach. And that's the account we probably most associate with Esau. He came back in from the field out doing some hunting. And Jacob had prepared a pot of stew, and he says, Jacob, give me some of that stew. I'm hungry. And Jacob says, give me your birthright. Give me the place of God's blessing, the position of God's blessing in our family. And Esau was like, let's see, pot of stew or the blessing of the Lord? I'll take the stew. Sure, you can have the birthright, whatever. And that's the characterization of Esau's life, is that he was ungodly. Some translations say unholy. He was profane. He did not have a sensitivity to God. He lived as if God did not exist. He would rather have a pot of stew in front of him than the blessing of God in his life. And I would suggest to you, I think this text suggests to us, that Esau didn't arrive at that place overnight. The sense is that God had disciplined Esau, God had tried to shape Esau, tried to get Esau's attention, tried to craft his character, and Esau had rejected that to the place where he became this desensitized to God, that he preferred a pot of stew to the blessing of God. There are some of you who need to respond to God's discipline, and you need to respond today. Because you've rejected it, and you've rejected it, and you've put it off, and you've squelched the conviction of God in your life. And there will come a day, if you continue on your present course, when you will no longer feel conviction of sin. And God will turn you over to your sin and allow you to feel the full repercussions of your sin. It's a dangerous, dangerous place to be. And Esau is the poster child for where unchecked sin leads us. And so guard against desensitization. Cultivate a tender, responsive conscience. How are you doing responding to the Lord's discipline? Maybe you've hit the wall. Maybe you're weary. Maybe feel under the press a little bit of circumstance, and maybe specifically the persecution of sinful people. But recognize that God is doing something in the midst of that. He's seeking to grow you up. How are you doing in responding to those areas?